Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Talk Radio. This is Max and Friends. I am your host, Max Tucci. Welcome to Max and Friends. If it's your first time joining me, I thank you so much for being here and for being part of the show. Yes, we've got a great, massively packed show tonight here on Max and Friends. Some amazing inspirational speeches, recordings. It will motivate you to really take this week into the max and just have a wonderful, wonderful week and moment, and just living in the beautiful now in this space that we just are in. I love it. It's just so good. Well, summer's here in full swing, so I've got some great summer songs that we're going to play for you tonight. Of course, Ash Ruiz, Burn. Let the Mother Earth burn. Because if we can't come to the party, then the party's going to come to us. I love that song and I love Ash. Check him out. And of course, we've got some Kelly Rowland coming up. That's my song. Oh, I love me some Kelly Rowland. When Love Takes Over. Yes, it does. When Love Takes Over, what happens in your life? Tweet me at Max Tucci. I see you, Ronnie, loving some Ash too. Hi to Ford. How you doing, Ford? Tuning in from New York City, and everyone tuning in from all over. So tonight we have some great speeches and talks, and inspirational talks, I should say, from my list of Max's favorite things. Of course, Ash Beckham, Hard Equals Hard. We have that tonight. We have some Alan Watts that will blow your mind. If you don't get it the first time, then I recommend you go to latalkradio.com/max, and there what you're going to get, you're going to get all of my archives. So click on today's show after the show and really write things down, because Alan Watts will blow your mind the second time around. So download this show is what I'm going to say. Hey, Auntie Rolanda Watts at Macy Gray at the Hollywood Bowl. Hey, if you all need to Google right now Rolanda Watts, because she has a great show. She's always here on Max and Friends. We love Auntie Ro. And definitely support her show and support all the shows here on LA Talk Radio, even though Auntie Ro's not on LA Talk Radio. Go anywhere you want. Support everybody. Love everybody. All right, we've got to get to this show. We've got some great talks. You're going to be motivated. You're going to be inspired. You're going to take life to the max for sure with this show, because we have Ash Beckham, Ash Ruiz, Alan Watts, and Kelly Rowland. How does that happen? It's called Max and Friends every Sunday night here on LA Talk Radio. I'm your host, Max Tucci. I'm going to love you and leave you, but only to leave you to some of my favorite, most inspirational songs, talks, and just moments of bliss. Speaking of bliss, we're going to be doing a retreat in Colorado with Shakti Durga, blissing out to the divine. So I'll keep you posted on that. Shakti Durga will be back to let you know what's up with that. And we've got a great couple of shows. We've got always great shows, but in the works, Noelle August is joining us in her book, Bounce, a Boomerang Novel. She's going to be here. And of course, Barbara Taylor Bradford's going to be back, and some of the housewives and so on and so forth. So always stay tuned to Max and Fran. Love makes me get... Okay, how you doing? I just got a text message. So I'm glad that love makes you get that way. Does that make... Yes, it does. So I will keep this message to myself. Speaking of messages, always tweet me at Max Tucci. Take life to the max. Love one another. Good night. Good karma. Even though I'm not really not going anywhere, because the show is going to go on. And these are going to be life classes for you. So be prepared to tune in. I love you all for listening to Max and Friends. Take this week and take this moment to the max. Good night. Good karma. Stay tuned. Be inspired. Be encouraged. And be motivated. I love you all for listening. And before I go, I've got to say hi to all of my Twitter people. I love you all. Thank you for tweeting me. Sexy and hot to go. That's my girl. She always tweets. Meganella, love you too. Keep tweeting at Max Tucci. Good night. And now stay tuned. tuned for Ash Beckham, Ash Ruiz, Alan Watts, and Kelly Rowland on Mix and Friends.
LA Talk Radio, this is Mix and Friends.
I'm going to talk to you tonight about coming out of the closet. And not in the traditional sense, not just the gay closet. I think we all have closets. Your closet may be telling someone you love her for the first time, or telling someone that you're pregnant, or telling someone you have cancer, or any of the other hard conversations we have throughout our lives. All a closet is a hard conversation. And although our topics may vary tremendously, the experience of being in and coming out of the closet is universal. It is scary, and we hate it, and it needs to be done. Several years ago, I was working at the Southside Walnut Cafe, a local diner in town, and during my time there, I would go through phases of militant lesbian intensity. Not shaving my armpits, quoting Ani DiFranco lyrics as gospel, and depending on the bagginess of my cargo shorts and how recently I had shaved my head, the question would often be sprung on me, usually by a little kid. Are you a boy or are you a girl? And there would be an awkward silence at the table. I'd clench my jaw a little tighter, hold my coffee pot with a little more vengeance. The dad would awkwardly shuffle his newspaper and the mom would shoot a chilling stare at her kid. But I would say nothing, and I would seethe inside. And it got to the point that every time I walked up to a table that had a kid anywhere between 3 and 10 years old, I was ready to fight. And that is a terrible feeling. So I promised myself the next time I would say something, I would have that hard conversation. So within a matter of weeks, it happens again. Are you a boy or are you a girl? Familiar silence, but this time I'm ready. And I am about to go all Women's Studies 101 on this table. I've got my Betty Friedan quotes, I've got my Gloria Steinem quotes, I even got this little bit from Vagina Monologues I'm going to do. So I take a deep breath and I look down, and staring back at me is a 4-year-old girl in a pink dress. Not a challenge to a feminist duel, just a kid with a question. Are you a boy or are you a girl? So I take another deep breath, squat down next to her and say, hey, I know it's kind of confusing. My hair is short like a boy's, and I wear boy's clothes, but I'm a girl. And you know how sometimes you like to wear a pink dress, and sometimes you like to wear your comfy jammies? Well, I'm more of a comfy jammies kind of girl. And this kid looks me dead in the eye without missing a beat and says, my favorite pajamas are purple with fish. Can I get a pancake, please? And that was it. Just, oh, okay, you're a girl. How about that pancake? It was the easiest hard conversation I have ever had. And why? Because Pancake Girl and I, we were both real with each other. So like many of us, I've lived in a few closets in my life, and yeah, most often, my walls happen to be rainbow. But inside, in the dark, you can't tell what color the walls are. You just know what it feels like to live in a closet. So really, my closet is no different than yours, or yours, or yours. Sure, I'll give you 100 reasons why coming out of my closet was harder than coming out of yours, but here's the thing. Hard is not relative. Hard is hard. Who can tell me that explaining to someone you just declared bankruptcy is harder than telling someone you just cheated on them? Who can tell me that his coming out story is harder than telling your 5-year-old you're getting a divorce? There is no harder. There is just hard. We need to stop ranking our heart against everyone else's heart to make us feel better or worse about our closets and just commiserate on the fact that we all have heart. At some point in our lives, we all live in closets, and they may feel safe, or at least safer than what lies on the other side of that door. But I am here to tell you, no matter what your walls are made of, a closet is no place for a person to live. Thanks. So why is coming out of any closet, why is having that conversation, why is it so hard? Because they're stressful. We're so concerned about the reaction of the other person, and understandably, will they be angry sad, disappointed? Will we lose a friend, a parent, a lover? These conversations cause stress. So let's geek out on stress for a minute. Stress is a natural reaction in your body. When you encounter a perceived threat, keyword perceived, your hypothalamus sounds the alarm and adrenaline and cortisol start coursing through your veins. This is known as fight or flight. Sometimes you rumble, sometimes you run, and this is a totally normal reaction and comes from a time when that threat was being chased by a woolly mammoth. The problem is your hypothalamus has no idea if you're being chased by a woolly mammoth or if your computer just crashed or if your in-laws just showed up on your doorstep or if you're about to jump out of a plane or you need to tell someone you love that you have a brain tumor. The difference is the woolly mammoth chases you for, what, maybe 10 minutes? Not having those hard conversations, that can go on for years and your body just can't handle that. Chronic exposure to adrenaline and cortisol disrupt almost every system in your body and can lead to anxiety, depression, heart disease, just to name a few. When you do not have hard conversations, when you keep the truth about yourself a secret, you are essentially holding a grenade. So imagine yourself 20 years ago. Me, I had a ponytail, a strapless dress, and high-heeled shoes. I was not the militant lesbian ready to fight any four-year-old that walked into the cafe. I was frozen by fear, curled up in the corner of my pitch-black closet, clutching my gay grenade. And moving one muscle is the scariest thing I have ever done. My family, my friends, complete strangers, I had spent my entire life trying to not disappoint these people, and now I was turning the world upside down on purpose. I was burning the pages of the script we had all followed for so long, but if you do not throw that grenade, it will kill you. One of my most memorable grenade tosses was at my sister's wedding. It was the first time that many in attendance knew I was gay. So in doing my maid of honor duties in my black dress and heels, I walked around to tables and finally landed on a table of my parents' friends, folks that had known me for years. And after a little small talk, one of the women shouted out, "I love Nathan Lane." And the battle of gay relatability had begun. "Ash, have you ever been to the Castro?" "Well, yeah, actually, we have friends in San Francisco." "Well, we've never been there, but we heard it's fabulous. Ash, do you know my hairdresser, Antonio? He's really good, and he has never talked about a girlfriend. Ash, what's your favorite TV show?" "Our favorite TV show? Favorite, Will and Grace. And you know who we love? Jack. Jack is our favorite." And then one woman, stumped, but wanting so desperately to show her support, to let me know she was on my side, she finally blurted out, "Well, sometimes my husband wears pink shirts." And I had a choice in that moment, as all grenade throwers do. I could go back to my girlfriend at my gay-loving table and mock their responses, chastise their unworldliness and their inability to jump through the politically correct gay hoops I had brought with me, or I could empathize with them and realize that that was maybe one of the hardest things that they had ever done. That starting and having that conversation was them coming out of their closets. Sure, it would have been easy to point out where they fell short. It's a lot harder to meet them where they are and acknowledge the fact that they were trying. And what else can you ask someone to do but try? If you're going to be real with someone, you got to be ready for real in return. So hard conversations are still not my strong suit, ask anybody I have ever dated. But I'm getting better, and I follow what I like to call the 3 pancake girl principles. Now, please, view this through gay-colored lenses, but know what it takes to come out of any closet is essentially the same. Number 1, be authentic. Take the armor off. Be yourself. That kid in the cafe had no armor, but I was ready for battle. Stupid hypothalamus. If you want someone to be real with you, they need to know that you bleed too. Number 2, be direct. Just say it. Rip the Band-Aid off. If you know you are gay, just say it. If you tell your parents you might be gay, they will hold out hope that this will change. Do not give them that sense of false hope. And number 3, and most important, be unapologetic. You are speaking your truth, never apologize for that. And some folks may have gotten hurt along the way, so sure, apologize for what you've done, but never apologize for who you are. And yeah, some folks may be disappointed, but that is on them, not on you. Those are their expectations of who you are, not yours. That is their story, not yours. The only story that matters is the one that you want to write. So the next time you find yourself in a pitch black closet clutching your grenade, know we have all been there before. And you may feel so very alone, but you are not. And we know it's hard, but we need you out here, no matter what your walls are made of. Because I guarantee you there are others peering through the keyhole of their closets looking for the next brave soul to bust the door open, so be that person. And show the world that we are bigger than our closets, and that a closet is no place for a person to truly live. Thank you, Boulder. Enjoy your night.
Let the mother earth burn. 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 Let the mother earth bur So now, this is the whole essence, you see, of seeing, if you really see into the secret, that the world doesn't contain any serious threats in it, because it's all the basic you running up behind itself and saying boo to see if you can get yourself to jump out of your skin. If you see that, be cool. That's the whole art of Zen, you know, is cool Hinduism. The Hindus come on a little strong when someone like Sri Ramakrishna or openly, pretty much openly announces that he's the Godhead. That's a little tough. And when Sri Ramana accepts the puja of all the followers and Sri Aurobindo sits every day for darshan, it's coming on a little strong. Well, the Zen people feel that that's just a bit too much. And the way they come on is they're ordinary. And they say when two Zen masters meet each other on the road, they need no introduction. When thieves meet, they recognize each other instantly. So they don't say anything, don't make any claims. As a matter of fact, so far from making claims, all good Zen masters say they have not attained anything, they have nothing to teach, and that's the truth. Because anybody who tells you that he is some way of leading you to spiritual enlightenment is just like somebody who picks your pocket and sells you your own watch. Of course, if you didn't know you had a watch, that might be the only way of getting you to realize. Now, so then, if, though, the people who do, by one means or another, prepared or unprepared, disciplined or undisciplined, get into this kind of interior secret about the nature of the universe, and they have hitherto been insecure about themselves, and they're going to use this secret as some way of creating trouble and of stirring things up and of boosting their own inadequate character structure, which is a word I prefer to use instead of ego, then there's trouble. Because those people who are out there on the tightrope are going to get pretty scared. And they're going to call in the police and say, this has got to stop. So then, we have a situation right like that now. And I want to make a few comments about it. First of all, the major group, it seems to me, that are crying panic about LSD are psychoanalysts. To them, this sort of thing is extremely threatening. Because psychoanalysis, in its theory, whether it be Freudian or whether it be Jungian, has a theory of the unconscious, which is not unrelated to the general philosophy of science of the 19th century, which is that the unconscious, called the libido by the Freudians, is totally uncivilized, blind lust. For the Jungians, it may be something even more dangerous than that, because they have not settled for the idea that it's a sexual unconscious. It may be much more sinister than that. Deep down, there is the spider mother. There are the screaming memes at the bottom of that pit. And Esther Harding, in her book Psychic Energy, says that civilization is a mere veneer over the abysmal depths of primeval slime, in which there are the great serpents and appalling influences, just waiting for a chance to get up there and raise hell. So if you are psychoanalytically oriented, you are necessarily terrified of the unconscious. But you've learned a trick, say the old-fashioned Christians, they discipline the unconscious with a club. Bible and birch rod, see? And they knocked it down. The Freudians said, no, this is a very dangerous creature, but you've got to train it in a different way, like a good horse trainer doesn't use the whip but lumps of sugar. But it's still the same animal. In other words, this whole philosophy of Western man as it crystallized in the late 18th, 19th, and early 20th centuries is that what we call humanity, consciousness, spirituality, values, is simply a veneer. The real thing underneath, the gutsy thing, is a terrible monster. And watch out for that. So anything that happens that might let that creature loose is looked upon by psychoanalysis as terrible. I'm not going to accuse them of worrying about LSD because they think they're going to be put out of a job. I don't think that LSD is an automatic psychotherapy at all. If you're going to use it for that purpose, you need psychotherapy in the ordinary way along with it. LSD is simply an exploratory instrument, like a microscope or a telescope, except this one's inside you instead of outside you. And according to your capacity and knowledge, you can use a microscope or a telescope to advantage. So in the same way, according to your capacity and your knowledge, you can use an interior instrument to your advantage. Or just for kicks. But when these people, you know, really feel threatened by this thing, they start sending around messages and public utterances which sound exactly as if they had taken LSD, had had a bad trip with it, and were coming on paranoid. And so they are spreading subtle rumors that this substance causes permanent brain damage and utter destruction of the superego. There are people in New York, likewise, who are spreading around the idea that, you see, once this thing has touched you, you are as if you've had a prefrontal lobotomy. You are somebody who ought to be put in a concentration camp because you've lost your conscience. You're out of order. Nothing more can be done about it. Now, do you see how alarming that could be in our day and age? Think that your brother, your aunt, has got permanent brain damage? Took some LSD? You see, the situation is exactly parallel. You know, the thing that we learn from history is nobody ever learns from history. Consider, just go back a few hundred years to the days of the Inquisition, and realize that the theologians of the church were in those days accorded the same kind of respect that we now accord to the professor of pathology at the University of California Medical School, or to the professor of physics at Caltech. We think those people are real authorities. They know it works. They've experimented. They have knowledge. They're the wisest people in our society. Oh, all right, a few hundred years ago, so were the theologians. And they had the same sense of responsibility towards the community that our great scientists and physicians have today. And they knew there was a thing called heresy going around that was not only capable, once you caught heresy, of making you damned to hell forever and ever and ever, to the most unimaginable tortures that would go on without end, but that it was infectious. And one heretic would soon make other heretics. So those entirely humanitarian and merciful church fathers got together and said, what are we going to do to stop this? Well, now they knew there is an eternal life beyond the grave. And so perhaps, just in the same way as if you've got a cancer, and that's something terrible because it might spread and destroy the whole body, cut it out, even burn it out if you have to. And a little pain on the part of the patient and several months on the end of tubes won't be too bad for if you get rid of it. So they said, we've got to torture these people because they might, in the middle of this extreme experience, recant. And if they won't recant, we'll burn them, because there's just the chance that in the agony of burning at the stake, they will say at the end, oh God, forgive me for my sins, and it'll be all right. Now realize the absolutely merciful intent behind the inquisitors. Perfectly responsible, acting on the best knowledge that they had in their day. Don't you see how that can happen again anytime? Permanent brain damage. People lost their sense of social responsibility, utterly destroyed by taking the wrong kind of drug. Now, dear friends, there is absolutely no evidence for this kind of thing whatsoever. The only brain damage that is, I've just checked this out with the most eminent authorities in this area on the subject, that the only permanent damage that's been perpetrated, and even that wasn't permanent, was on some cats who were given doses that would be equivalent to a human being to over 2,000 micrograms of LSD, the normal dosage for a human being being about 1 to 200. But give a cat the equivalent for a human being of 2,000 micrograms, there will be synaptic defects that are called acute as distinct from chronic. That means they will disappear after a little while. Now, this has been worked out carefully. And there is no evidence whatsoever of any serious neurological damage to a human being, except in cases where A, they may have taken an absurdly large dose, or B, taken it in conjunction with some other form of drug, an amphetamine, a barbiturate, or something like methadone, a narcotic, which did indeed cut off the oxygen supply to the brain and therefore cause some damage. So this scare talk is simply without foundation. But nevertheless, there are certain reasons to be cautious and for those who understand the operation of these chemicals to issue certain clear warnings. And this I want to talk about quite seriously. Now, this class of psychotropic chemicals, which includes LSD, mescaline, and its original form, peyote, psilocybin, cannabis, and so on, which is a very mild psychotropic. These do not, in moderation and proper use, in any way harm the physical organism, nor form such habits that you can't get rid of them without unpleasant withdrawal symptoms. But if you take them in absurdly large doses, you are in for trouble. I knew a Methodist minister who was a very violent teetotalitarian and became extremely sick from drinking too much milk. So after all, if you sit down and you buy a bottle of whiskey, which you can get at any store anywhere, perfectly legit, and you consume the one quart of whiskey in 1 hour, you can expect trouble. So in the same way, if you've got LSD or something of that kind and you take 1,000 micrograms because some friend of yours took 500 and you want to one-up him, watch out. You're being just stupid. Furthermore, you're being rather stupid if you buy the kind of LSD that is currently being circulated in the black market. Because, for two reasons, you don't know what else is in it and you don't know how much is in it. There are two sorts of producers of LSD on the black market. One is the enthusiastic graduate student in chemistry who wants to turn the whole world on. And his product is apt to be pretty good, but excessive in dosage. And what says 100 micrograms may well be 300. There is another kind of producer who wants to make a good thing out of it, who wants to give you a big jazz, but he'll mix it with amphetamines. There's another more sinister kind of producer who'll either cut the amount or mix it with heroin or anything, any other substance, maybe again amphetamines or whatever, they'll get you hooked on it. So there is no control of the quality of what is being circulated, none whatever. And you just don't know what you're getting. Now, this situation is the result of the fact that the United States never learns from history. It is the same old story of prohibition. To think the naive notion that you can control something that might turn into a social evil by handing it over to the police. Now, after all, who pays the police? You do. And if you can't control yourself, the police won't control you either. But in lieu of controlling you, they can suppress you. Now, in all conscience, the police have enough to do. Not only to control the traffic, which just gets worse every day by virtue of Parkinson's law, but also all the possibilities of robbery, violence, murder, and so on and so forth, which is a full-time job. But to ask the police to go and look for people who have LSD or marijuana or heroin or opium or whatever, or who are living irregular sex lives, or who have a gambling joint or a whorehouse, this is to ask the police to act as officers of the state in service of the church, uniformed ministers. And that's not their job. And when the police are asked to do that, they are put by lawmakers into a position which brings them into public disrespect, as it did in the days of Prohibition. It is not fair to the police. Because if you send the police to hunt out LSD, it is a far more tough job than looking for a needle in a haystack. LSD can be disguised as anything whatsoever. It can be mixed with gum and put on an envelope. It can be entirely absorbed, vast quantities of it, into a piece of Kleenex. The alcoholic base is then allowed to evaporate, and nobody would know it from any other dirty piece of Kleenex that somebody stuck away in his pocket. It can then be reactivated. It can be made into lacquer to coat pins with. Anything. It can be disguised as peanut butter, orange juice, aspirin, just sugar, anything you want. And it's very difficult indeed to detect. So when you try to suppress that sort of thing by law, you leave the gates wide open for every kind of blackmail. You want to get rid of your wife? Or your unfortunate business competitor? Just slip them some. And then arrange by a roundabout way to tip off the cops. The senator you don't like? Political rival? Psst. You see, any law of this nature, any law which in a way tries to enforce by the power of the state private morals or your own business in looking after your own nervous system is in effect an unenforceable law. And all unenforceable laws lead to blackmail and to public demoralization. The only way to handle a thing of this kind is to bring it all out into the open. Nothing can be controlled when it's driven underground. It ought to be controlled. Just in the same way as we have learned how to control automobiles, we license people to drive them. So in the same way, we don't sell liquor to minors. We expect them to have some kind of education and grown-up responsibility before they go boozing around. So in exactly the same way, society has got to face the fact that it's going to have to license people for certain spiritual adventures, or perhaps just plain pleasures, if that's what you want to call it. After all, you can't even join some churches without, can't join the Catholic Church without taking a course of instruction. That takes a few weeks, and then they put you through an initiation. And you may say when you get through that, well, what was all that preparation for? I didn't feel anything. But so in exactly the same way with this, it is completely urgent, in other words, that we prevent the occurrence of a very serious, socially destructive criminal situation created by law. You've heard of iatrogenic diseases. That means diseases caused by physicians. There are nomogenic diseases, or shall we say nomogenic crimes. Like somebody said, the only serious side effect of marijuana is that you may go to jail. This is a nomogenic crime. In other words, it is a ritual crime. In exactly the same way that when the early Christians refused to burn incense in front of the Roman gods, in whom the Romans themselves didn't believe, they were guilty of a crime. It was a ritual crime. And they refused. And a reasonable man like the Emperor Marcus Aurelius said to the Christians, "Now come off it. Really? Do you have to refuse to burn incense?" They said, "Yes, we're serious about it." So these are ritual crimes. And so in the same way, various ritual crimes exist, and our police, poor devils, are supposed to enforce it. And if they don't, they're going to get it from the politicians. Because the politicians have made all the old ladies up in Glendale scared, and Pasadena and so on. They're all just terrified about this. And so the politician gets the votes of those old ladies. And the police have to do what the politician tells them to do. And you know, the police, they're just people. And, it's a terrible thing to put the police in a position where they're going to earn public disrespect by enforcing or trying to enforce unenforceable laws. So I would say in general, to sum up, substances like LSD, which give away a secret about the nature of the social game, the human game, and what underlies it, are potentially dangerous, of course, like any good thing is. Electricity is dangerous, fire is dangerous, cars are dangerous, planes are dangerous, but not so dangerous as driving on the freeway. The only way to handle danger is to face it. If you start getting frightened of it, then you make it worse. Because you project onto it all kinds of bogeys and threats which don't exist in it at all. So this is also a rule. And please, anybody here who's a psychotherapist, if he doesn't know this already, take note. If you get someone thrown on your hands who, as a result of taking any psychotropic drug, is in a psychotic state, don't be frightened. Because the moment you're afraid, your patient will pick up your fear by kind of osmosis and get worse. The rule about all terrors, going back to where I started from, the dweller on the threshold, the rule for all terrors is head straight into them. When you are sailing in a storm, you don't let a wave hit your boat on the side. You go bow into the wave and ride it. So in the same way, old folklore says, this is an old wives' tale with a lot of truth in it, whenever you meet a ghost, don't run away. Because the ghost will capture the substance of your fear and materialize itself out of your own substance and will kill you eventually, because it will take over all your own vitality. So then, whenever confronted with a ghost, walk straight into it and it will disappear. And so in the same way, when people stir up the depths of the unconscious and are confronted with their own monsters, or with the terrors of discovering that they're in a relativistic world where black implies white and white implies black, so who's in charge? You know, grandfather's dead, father's dead too, this leaves me. Ooh, who's the authority? See? When you get that sense of terror, go right at it. Don't run away. Explore. Feel fear as completely as you can feel it. Head straight into it. And just it so happens that these things give you the property, and the opportunity, let me put it that way, the opportunity to go into some of your very, very most closely kept skeletons. And the result of that is invariably beneficial. That what I want, basically, what I really want is what you want. And I don't know what you want. Surprise me. But that's the kinship between I and thou. So when I ask, I go right down to the question, which we started with. What do I want? The answer is, I don't know. When Bodhidharma was asked, who are you? Which is another form of the same question. He said, I don't know. Planting flowers to which the butterflies come. Bodhidharma says, I know not. I don't know what I want. Well, when you don't know what you want, you've reached the state of desirelessness. When you really don't know. You see, there's a beginning stage of not knowing and there's an ending stage of not knowing. In the beginning stage, you don't know what you want because you haven't thought about it, or you've only thought superficially. And then when somebody forces you to think about it and go through and say, yeah, I think I'd like this, I think I'd like that, I think I'd like the other, that's the middle stage. And then you get beyond that, say, is that what I really want? In the end you say, no, I don't think that's it. I might be satisfied with it for a while, and I wouldn't turn my nose up at it. But it's not really what I want. Why don't you really know what you want? Two reasons that you don't really know what you want. Number one, you have it. Number two, you don't know yourself, because you never can. The Godhead is never an object of its own knowledge. Just as a knife doesn't cut itself, fire doesn't burn itself, light doesn't illumine itself. It's always an endless mystery to itself. I don't know. And this I don't know, uttered in the infinite interior of the spirit, this I don't know is the same thing as I love, I let go, I don't try to force or control. It's the same thing as humility. And so the Upanishads say, if you think that you understand Brahman, you do not understand. And you have yet to be instructed further. If you know that you do not understand, then you truly understand. For the Brahman is unknown to those who know it, and known to those who know it not. And the principle is that any time you, as it were, voluntarily let up control, in other words, cease to cling to yourself, you have an access of power. Because you're wasting energy all the time in self-defense, trying to manage things, trying to force things to conform to your will. The moment you stop doing that, that wasted energy is available. And therefore, you are, in that sense, having that energy available, you are one with the divine principle. You have the energy. When you're trying, however, to act as if you were God, that is to say, you don't trust anybody and you're the dictator and you have to keep everybody in line, you lose the divine energy. Because what you're doing is simply defending yourself. So then, the principle is, the more you give it away, the more it comes back. Now you say, I don't have the courage to give it away. I'm afraid. And you can only overcome that by realizing, you better give it away, because there's no way of holding on to it. The meaning of the fact, you see, that everything is dissolving constantly, that we're all falling apart, we're all in a process of constant death, and that the worldly hope men set their hearts upon turns ashes, or it prospers, and like snow upon the desert's dusty face, lighting a little hour or two is gone, you know, all that Omar Khayyam jazz. You know, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the great globe itself, I, all which it inherits, shall dissolve, and like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. All falling apart. Everything is. That's the great assistance to you.
That fact that everything is in decay is your helper. That is allowing you that you don't have to let go because there's nothing to hold on to. It's achieved for you, in other words, by the process of nature. So once you see that you just don't have a prayer, and it's all washed up, and that you will vanish and leave not a rack behind, and you really get with that, suddenly you find you have the power, this enormous access of energy. But it's not power that came to you because you grabbed it. It came in entirely the opposite way. And power that comes to you in that opposite way is power with which you can be trusted.
LA Talk Radio, this is Max and Friends.
It's complicated, it always is. That's just the way it goes. Feels like I waited so long for this. I wonder if it shows. When love takes over, when love takes over.